The Good Rain is journalist Timothy Egan's book about the Pacific Northwest. In it, he traced the trail of Theodore Winthrop, an adventurer who came to the Pacific Northwest in 1853. To cover the story, Egan hiked along the Olympic Mountains, drove through farmlands in eastern Washington, climbed the Cascades, and kayaked the waters of Puget Sound. And of course, he found a region considerably changed from Winthrop's days. When he kayaked into Seattle's Elliott Bay, Egan observed a duality he found common throughout the Northwest. He wrote, "Some say Seattle should aspire to be the Paris of Puget Sound, accepting growth with grand European style and direction, a meeting of the ideal with the inevitable. Others want to seal the city entirely, drawing a line at the forested edge and putting up the keep-out signs. What's important about Seattle, they say, is not glass and steel and money, those are the elements of Texas, but air and light and water." Seattle is one of the cities Egan covers for the New York Times. The region is so vast, I asked him how he decides what to cover.
I break down my coverage into two general areas. The first is the resource issues. This area happens to have the world's biggest and some of its oldest trees. It used to have one of its greatest fish runs. It is one of its great agricultural centers. In the mines of the interior, it still produced a lot of the silver, lead, and gold of this country. So there are these huge resource issues, you know, what to do with these vast things that we originally scraped out of the ground and knocked down at such a terrific rate. And now most of us seem to be in love with and want to try to save them somehow. Most of these resources, by the way, are owned by the great majority of the American public. They're public resources. They're on public lands. So that's the first general area. The second has to do with the cities. I like to think that the three major cities of the Northwest, and I include Vancouver, British Columbia in that, are sort of models for the way new cities can become and remain livable. At least they like to think of themselves as that. And they like to think of themselves as a counter to the rusting and older cities of the East. So I think that there's a lot of fascination in this country and elsewhere as well, as evidenced by the some of the talks I had with people during the Goodwill Games, about how these cities are coping, developing, trying to change, trying to forge new urban ways of life.
You see the Pacific Northwest as representing a model for other ways of life. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Well, it's very simply this, that and this is, goes back to what Jefferson talked about in some of his writings about what America could be, is that there's a duality of the wild and the civilized, that you can live in the city, you can live in a place of 2 million people, and still within an hour is this perhaps illusory wild dream, the idea that you can be floating down a river that's undammed, or you can catch a salmon, or you can be atop a mountain. The Alpine Lakes Wilderness area, where there are 600 lakes, is within 45 minutes of the city of Seattle. And again, I think it may be becoming increasingly difficult to obtain this dream, but that is the Pacific Northwest ideal, that you live in this very civilized urban center, but the wild is your back door. It's just right there.
Your account, The Good Rain, is of a tour through the Pacific Northwest. It's kind of the spine of an account of life in the Northwest. Did you have to assign yourself to do this story?
No, actually, I wasn't working for the New York Times when I started this book. Midway into the research, I went to work for the Times. So I was actually inspired to follow the footsteps of the person who wrote a book in 1853, and that acts as sort of the narrative spine and inspiration for this book. So I had all these loose ends about the Northwest, and when I read this 1853 account, which was called The Canoe in the Saddle, and written by the great-great-great-grandson of the founder of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, it occurred to me that it was just a terrific thing to use as a gauge as to how the Northwest had changed.
You mentioned that you have some loose ends about the Pacific Northwest. I wonder what some of those are.
I really was curious about the place that I live on this planet and the three generations of my family that had been here. And what I found most fascinating to me, first of all, I mean, there are 27 Indian tribes in the state of Washington. The Pacific Northwest was the most densely populated area of Aboriginal Americans in what is now the lower 48. And that culture absolutely fascinated me. I had always looked at it like a lot of people from afar, as just to being a kind of totem poles and salmon eaters. And it was only when I got out and visited some of the tribes that I saw that there is a strong strand of that culture still alive, and B, how quickly it did vanish when it was so big. I mean, there were nearly 100,000 people living at the mouths of streams along the coast of the Pacific Northwest before European contact. That is an awful lot of people. And when I started doing this research, I remember one thing in particular. This image has never left me. Being down on the Columbia River early morning and seeing a Native American out on his old plywood dip net platform trying to pull in a salmon in the way that his ancestors always had. And behind him is this huge dam sending out 1,000 megawatts of power, most of it to Los Angeles, and this river, which is utter glass, and sitting out there like almost like a museum piece, like a living museum piece, this person trying desperately to do something against the impossibilities of time and tide that his ancestors had always done. And that struck me as the ultimate Northwest image.
The Pacific Northwest is being revered, yet it's also been the site of some terrible press as well. I mean, there's a whole series of Green River murders. And I wonder for you, what is the dark side of the Pacific Northwest, not just the wintertime and the rains?
That's an interesting point. I read an interview with David Lynch recently, who, as you may know, grew up in Missoula, Montana, and parts of Spokane, and spent time in Seattle as well. And he was asked whether his television show Twin Peaks is a sort of Northwest Gothic. And he said that it is, in a sense, that he's this dark side. Of course, in Twin Peaks, it's a dark comic side, but this dark side is something he's developed. This is the edge of the continent, and maybe people, when they come here and can't fulfill their dreams, they go inward into their darker sides, and that's why you have strange crimes, serial killers. You don't have a lot of random violence, such as you have in the bigger cities of the East, but you have these, you had a rapist in Spokane 6-7 years ago who was the son of the managing editor of the paper, and he had raped, God knows, 30, 40 women. Of course, Bundy was here. The Green River Killer stopped killing in 1984. The killings have never been solved. But maybe there is this, on an artistic level, you could call it Northwest Gothic. On a more realistic level, you could just say it's a internalization of the bleaker parts of all of us.
The plenty of the Pacific Northwest has been spent rather profligately in the past couple of years. We're seeing now the Hanford nuclear power plant is being a site of toxic wastes. Of nuclear wastes. When you fly over the Pacific Northwest, you see all the clear-cutting squares of land with the little narrow strips of trees along the side of the road so that motorists don't see that the hills are actually clear-cut. It seems that in many ways people of the Pacific Northwest have been living an illusion in the past decade or so.
There is a piece in The New Yorker about the ancient forest, and the kicker of the story was what you just mentioned, these so-called visual corridors that state law requires that you can go and absolutely devastate a mountain denuded of trees, but you must keep this little narrow band of evergreens along the road so that the tourist driving along has no idea what's going on behind the thin veil of trees. I think that's right in large part, and that's why there's such a big fight going on over the forest right now. This part of the world is utterly polarized over what to do with the future of its forest. And that's because so much of it is gone, so little of it is left. But on the other hand, you have three huge national parks and some 5 million acres of wilderness within an hour or two of most of the cities. So the people here have at least, they're miles ahead of their countrymen in trying to save what is defining about their area. Now they're trying to save or decide what to do with that last and I think most original resource of the Pacific Northwest. These big, ancient trees.
Do you have any ambivalence about lauding the Pacific Northwest as a place to live, while at the same time stressing the drawbacks of having people come there?
I think everybody who lives here, whether they're a native such as myself or somebody who's only been here 2 weeks, I seem to have talked to a lot of people this summer who decided to move here this summer. We had a fairly nice summer, unfortunately, so it drew some people here. But I think everyone who's come here, I mean, people who come here just for a week end up saying the same thing. Geez, this area is so fragile. You've got to do something to save it. You can't laud it without feeling a pang of guilt. And I do feel that. And it's very difficult. You realize that you have this wonderful thing, but on the other hand, you want to freeze it.
Well, Timothy Egan, thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Timothy Egan covers the Pacific Northwest for The New York Times. His book, is the good rain.